This TFMR podcast is brought to you by your friends at JM Bullion. Visit jmbullion.com for all your gold and silver bullion needs. Well, hello, everybody, at TFMR. It is time for your Thursday conversation. But once again, we got the calendar issues here. We're recording your Thursday conversation on Wednesday. But of course, you're listening to it as it's being posted on Friday, or maybe you're listening to it on Saturday. So anyway, obviously, I'm just getting old. I don't know what day it is anymore. Anyway, your Thursday conversation this week should be a rollicking good time. As I have on the line, a guy who I now constitutes as an old friend, because I've known him for a while. And he is Professor David Cullum. He is the Betty Miller Chair of the Chemistry Department at Cornell. Is that right?
Well, the Betty R. Miller Chair is the endowed salary line, and I was formerly department chair.
Got it. Okay, so there you go. And you specialize in organic chemistry, correct, Dave?
Yes.
God, yes. I can't even. I think I've told you before. I took organic chemistry back in my hallowed days at University of Nebraska. And the only way I got through it was the professor would let us keep like a 3x5 card with the, you know, you take a mechanical pencil, you write as small as you can.
Right.
It amazes me that anybody knows it well enough that you can teach it to somebody.
It's like a foreign language.
Yes. It is. And
it's just a vocabulary syntax combo problem.
And for my ADHD, Dave, that's a bad combo.
Right.
So anyway, like I said, I love speaking with you though, because you're a renaissance man. You keep track of everything. You compile it every year, which in kind of, I guess we'll call it a labor of love. You call it your year in review that you post at Chris Martinson's site, and then it gets picked up. And spread around the internet. As we get started, Dave, again, tell everybody why you started writing that so many years ago, what they could find in this year. It's still only January. It's still worth going back and reading. And I don't know, what else is on your mind as the year gets going?
Well, I started writing it back around. I wrote little sort of prototypes of it. Maybe in 08, 09, I decided I'd been an investor for 30 years. So I said, I'm going to take a serious shot at this thing. And it got a lot of clicks. And then I started getting emails from the most bizarre sources. Like all of a sudden I opened my email box one day and there's David Einhorn's email. And I go, what? And he'd read, and apparently he'd pass it around his friends in the hedge fund world. And they were discussing it. And so that kind of lit me up. And then every year it's gotten more and more elaborate. So early things were purely economics. I was just talking about what I thought was going on in the gold market and the equity market and stuff like that. And I'd come off a 30-year stretch, which I'd kicked a lot of asses pretty good. So in the decade, a good decade with bonds in the 80s, I switched to equities after the crash in 87. I rode them up and was a drooling, moronic bull up until around 98, then got nervous, started to understand market structure and said something's wrong here. Switched basically out of equities by mid-99 into gold and cash and a prudent bear short fund with David Tice. And then sort of therefore did, at first was doing poorly relative to my peers because it was late 99 and they were making, 10% a week sort of returns. But then they gave it all back plus room to spare. And I my gold started going up in 01. And so for me, the best decade graded on a curve was the noughts, where while equity investors were getting clobbered by two bear markets, compounded 13% a year, actually. And so around 09, I could write with a vengeance with a pretty good tailwind supporting it. I largely missed the equity run from 09 up because I thought the market had another factor of two down in it.
Yeah. Yep.
And I believed that everything was a sucker's rally. And by the time you can think, well, this looks like it's going to stick, it was already way overvalued again. And so I just, I had a few equities here and there, and gold did okay during that period, but it went through a went through a pretty flat period from what was it, about 13? Is that when it's,
yeah, 13 to 18.
I started getting, yeah. And I bought some more gold at around 1200, which is a pretty good well time. But now I'm just sitting there hunkered down in my bunker of doom waiting for the next downturn, which feels imminent to me. To finish up the year in review part, it got more and more political, more and more social, more and more, because those are related to the markets. And it got big. I think it topped out at 311 pages one year. But it turns out I'm now generating more ideas on what to write about than I can possibly write about. So yeah. I left stuff on the cutting room floor that was painful as hell. I'm still working on a part of it. That's going to be about 100-page write up on human trafficking, actually. And whether I actually publish it is a good question, because I do not want to end up in quarter in a box. So,
well, yeah, sadly, those are things you got to think about.
Right.
Well, as we wrap, you know, last year was an interesting year, no doubt about it. I mean, everybody kind of was waiting for the recession to begin that didn't begin. And the right. Fed to shift policy, which didn't happen. As we talk today, let's kind of hit two main topics. Let's start with the economy and the Fed and the markets and gold. And I want to get all your thoughts on that. But then, you know, like I said, you keep track of everything, and you're in a unique position to do it, you know, working at an Ivy League school. So let's in the back half talking about society at large and the election and all that kind of stuff. So that's kind of where we'll go. Dave, as the year begins, with the stock markets at near all-time highs again, maybe putting in a double top, maybe not.
The double top looks pretty provocative, doesn't it? I'm not a TNA guy. I'm a TNA guy. I'm not a TA guy.
It does look provocative, though. You know, and to me, and I mentioned this to people on my site, I have this deja vu, maybe is the right sense, you know, that's a lot like the first quarter of 2008, where everybody's whistling past the graveyard and everything's going up, stock market's going up, commodities going up and everything. And then, you know, the bottom drops out with Bear Stearns and, you know, all through the summer. How do you see this as the year begins?
Well, as we talked about before the podcast, it kind of feels to me like sort of March of 07, where I think you can hear audible cracking noises in the market if you listen. So I think commercial real estate starting to let go. I think residential real estate showing just the very beginnings of letting go. They have to let go. They absolutely mandatorily, there's no question it has to let go, because if you double the costs of owning a house at the same prices, then the prices have to cut in half, crudely speaking, right? People aren't just all of a sudden going to pay twice as much for a house. Which is what, you know, if some percentage of your monthly payment is taxes, some percentage is mortgage. If the mortgage rates are 7% instead of 3%, I don't see how the retail housing market holds up. And the private capital guys who bought up hundreds of thousands of houses, they use sort of a balloon mortgage system. They didn't buy 30-year mortgages to buy all those hundreds of thousands of houses. So they are now starting to hit on profitability too. So I think those guys, I think the Airbnb squad that thought buying a house with an adjustable rate loan at 3% was a good way to make money. And once the price of the house goes down, then they got to get out. They're scared to death. And so that selling will start. And I think once housing goes, once real estate goes, and you're starting to hear rumors of layoffs. They're anecdotal. Someone was picking on a woman named Melody Wright, did a podcast with Adam Taggart. And some guy was picking on her, saying she doesn't know what the hell she's talking about. But what she was picking up were little anecdotes about housing starting to drop. And right now, you're not going to see it on a plot. You're not going to see it. You're not going to see it in some sort of metric. You're going to see it by just noticing here and there, where all of a sudden, you know, sellers are starting to drop their price. And it's not showing up in the new house market, supposedly. It's in the used house market that it's showing up. Mm-hmm. So I think the beginning of a cascading failure has begun.
that bleed over, leach over into the equity markets and every place else?
Well, I think it has to, right? I mean, that people somehow, any notion that the Fed has some magic knob they can just twirl
Right.
is refuted by centuries of failure of them to twirl the magic knob to prevent pain, right? When was the last time the Fed actually prevented a serious downturn from causing pain? And they philosophically seem to think they can clean up the pain, clean up the mess, the debris after it's done anyway. So they have a history of saying, look, we're just going to step back and wait until, the raging inferno is kind of burned down, then we'll sort of hose down the embers and try to put it out at the end. I think the grotesque flawed assumption might be that we will then at that point do some mystical, magical V bounce back up to new highs. And that's what's happened for 40 years. But I believe there's an argument, which I made, I've spent probably 100 pages making it this year, that the age of V bounces might be over. The last 40 years of V bounces produced an expansion of valuations, which is unprecedented. And so I think to think the next 40 years are going to be the same is requires a certain amount of it's a triumph of delusion.
Well, let's talk about that because you mentioned, in your history back in the late 90s, I remember that too. I owned a stock called CMGI. Do you remember that one?
Yeah, oh yes,
And it was this,
absolutely.
I don't even
I
like
think Chris
this.
Martinson shorted it. I think Rick shorted that one.
He was shorting the shares. I was long. But you mentioned, kind of getting the your spidey senses going off back then. And again in 2007, you kind of get that feeling now with the valuations in the stock market.
To me, in some sense, it feels worse. So what you're missing is the retail euphoria. So you don't have 125% mortgages like you did. And so there's certain things that are missing. And I think people are taking some solace in the fact that these indicators from the past downturns are missing, and therefore we're not in trouble. And I go, well, since all the downturns have their own unique characteristics, I would not use traditional metrics. It's like the Fed said, housing market never nationally drops, and then it got crushed, right?
Right.
So those clowns didn't see it coming. An anecdote I like to tell is in 1991, there was a poll of 51 economists, and none of them said we would have a recession in 1991. The poll was done. We were 6 months into one.
Yeah, right.
And they couldn't even see it. So if you're waiting for someone to tell you, it's not going to happen. And the absence of people telling you means it's going to happen. Right? And so it's that euphoria. It's a different kind of a euphoria, though. It's a different kind of euphoria. I think everyone knows we're in trouble, but people think it's safe because it's not yet showing up.
Yeah. You still have the I've said several times, the biggest fear in the market at this point is still the fear of missing out.
Right. The FOMO guys are still in there. As we were talking about beforehand, again, I posted a couple of tweets about Nvidia, at one point trading at 50 times revenues, PE of 278, selling overpriced hardware, according to Fred Hickey. Apple, since 2015, their revenues have risen 64%, which is actually pretty good considering the fact that I thought it was worse than that. Their phones are not selling that well. They've got no new products. And so where are these revenues coming from? Probably cloud shit. But their share price has risen 600%. Microsoft from over the last 12 years has risen something like tenfold, of which fivefold of that, meaning all but twofold, was valuation expansion. They came from relatively low PEs to relatively high PEs and got a fivefold gain out of that. And one thing I know is that valuation expansion has always followed, always, without fail, through the history of markets, by valuation contraction. Because high valuations lead to low valuations, lead to high valuations. It happens over and over and over. So if somehow you want to make the argument that markets will never regress to the mean, you're welcome to make that assumption, but you're going to get hurt.
You make me think of something else that comes up often when I get interviewed, and I talk about this idea of the crack up boom. Remember that being something that, when everybody's reading first about the Weimar Republic back in 2009 and 2010, the crack up boom became something that was, people were studying. Could we be on the verge of that? I mean, I look at this,
We could.
the only growth that the US economy has seems to be directly related to the government deficits. And that just seems to be expanding all the time. So is there a way that, like other markets have seen in the past, if you hyperinflate your currency, that, the stock market does pretty well.
Does pretty well nominally,
Right, nominally.
right? Well, the problem is if it does poorly, inflation adjusted, one thing doesn't happen is people's salaries don't do well inflation adjusted, and so salaries are very sticky. I mean, there are people who can adjust their salaries by raising the price of the service they provide, but a lot of people are locked into contracts and stuff, and so their salaries aren't going to change. And if we have a downturn that's also inflationary, the demand for labor is going to cut way back, so therefore the salaries are not going to get chased up. And at the same time, you've got an inflationary mess. I marvel at the idiocy of the markets when, for example, stagflation showed up. And the economists were all shocked. They didn't think it was even a theoretical construct. And the more I thought about it, I said, this is insane, actually. If you tell me we're going to go through a period where inflation is really bad, and therefore you can't buy a fraction of what you used to be able to buy with the same number of dollars, how is that not stagnating?
What
How does inflation not cause stagnation? That's the question I would ask. I flipped the question.
you ever walk across campus there, Dave, over to the whatever building that all the economists are in there with their
Humanists.
fuzzy heads and stuff and ask them what they think?
I'll tell you why that's usually not productive, because most of them are really doing econometrics. So I think it was Samuelson who brought math into economics. So economic fields are always looking for a way to bring in scholarship. And so if you look at various fields, you say, how do you bring in scholarship? Bring in math, bring in sophisticated physics, bring in whatever it is that makes your peers think, wow, this guy's special. Samuelson brought in mathematics, and so everything became a model. And we ceased to put out economists. One time I asked an economist who lives down the street from me, when do you learn about sort of the history of economics? When do you learn about what the great thinkers were saying? How many people can graduate from Cornell with an economics major without having read The Wealth of Nations, or without having read any Hayek, or without having read any of those guys? There's Marx, you name it. And the answer is probably most, is my guess. They're studying differential equations, and they're studying statistical models, and they're learning how to code. All that's cool, but I don't think it actually contributes to understanding the world at in an intuitive level. So I'm unfettered by that sort of approach. So I have a question I ask scientists. I say, what famous scientist most reminds you of yourself? Now, it's a tough question, because if you name a famous one, you go, well, but they don't, because they're so much smarter than me. But stylistically, and I have a very clear answer for me, that's Einstein. And the reason is because Einstein would build these mental models that really were beets and carrots. He'd say, imagine, a train moving at the speed of light and blah, blah, blah. And he'd come up with this construct. He'd say, therefore, and he'd come to some great epiphany. And then he'd sort of backfill the math and shit and come up with his theories and write a paper. But it was the mental constructs that he was a genius at, whereas Newton was all math, is pure math. And so it's the economists, I don't think, are learning intuition.
Very good point. I'm sitting here thinking while you're talking. My degree from the that again the hallowed halls of the University of Nebraska-Lincoln I have a BS in economics, and this was in 1989, and I was never asked to read Hayek,
Right.
or anything from Milton Friedman or anything like that, but I could sure as hell draw a great curve of aggregate supply and aggregate demand.
Right. And so then the question is, things like, let's say you take what's his face's book, The Price of Time. Who's the goddamn author of that? God damn it. My brain loses.
You got
the
me.
Price
on
of
one.
Time. Price of Time by famous Edward Chancellor. I'm sure they're not reading that, yet it's a brilliant treatise on what happens when interest rates get too low. And he says that without fail, when interest rates get down to 2%, you have a crisis. Well, we got negative.
Yeah.
Real rates, we got way negative. Europe yep. actually got negative. So either Chancellor's wrong or we're going to have a crisis. And the fact that the crisis hasn't arrived doesn't mean that it's not coming. It just means it takes time. Price yeah. of time, if you wish, right?
You had to pick something, you know, the Jenga cube that you pull out that collapses the whole thing.
The other thing is quick corrections don't do any good because dip buyers show up. What you have to do to really correct the markets is what you have to do is you have to demoralize investors to really form a good bottom. Take the end of 67 to 81. It took 14 years, which is painfully long period for many people. It's a third of your investing life, really, because you're too young to pick up anymore. And by the time you've been investing for 45 years, you it's time to go to something real safe and not try to win. Just try not to lose. And so 14 years, the inflation adjusted markets went down 75%. So losing 75% is bad. Losing it over 14 years is bad, is super bad. By the time you got to 1981, when the markets were really dirt cheap, admittedly with inflation screaming at us. So that's the problem. Then investors, you couldn't give away equities. They had the market at a PE of 6 or something like that. And so green shoots. At the very bottom, when pessimism reaches an absolute minimum, which is measured by price, so price reflects optimism, pessimism. At the very bottom, when pessimism absolutely maximizes indicated by price, the reasoning for pessimism goes to zero. You're about to make a bottom and you're at maximum pessimism. So same's true with the top.
Yeah.
So on some Tuesday afternoon at 2:03 p.m., the markets will make their final top before a very long, painful period of attitude correction. And I think what I wrote about this year is I think there's a case for ignoring the various gyrations and rallies and shit. I think there's an argument for a 40-year bear market.
It wouldn't be unprecedented. And no one's ever
it wouldn't. Well, that's the problem. It's not unprecedented, but it's not in the memory of the people who are actually pulling the levers right now.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, Japan's a great example. In 1989, not only was Japan profoundly overpriced, but 14 of the 20 biggest companies in the world were Japanese. So for someone to say, well, how can you go wrong investing in the Nikkei because it's all the winners? Right. It's all the winners.
Yep.
You go, well, that's exactly why it went bad. And now you got the Mag 7 and none of them are cheap. None of them. Tesla sells, I don't know, 2 or 3% of the cars and that's 50% of the market cap.
Mm-hmm.
NVIDIA is ridiculous. It's like Salesforce.com. You got Microsoft, which has expanded its valuation fivefold. You got Apple, which has expanded its valuation fivefold. And a bunch of others. I don't see how this can work unless you want to make the assumption it will never get cheap again.
Yeah.
At which point you're going to get a shitty return. Because right now, Apple's priced to return 3%. They got a PE of 33.
Do you really want to
buy something that overpriced to get a 3% return? I don't think so.
The analogy to Japan's pretty good, Dave, because, in the late 80s, that was all the rage. And as it fell, what did the Japanese demographics fell apart. The Bank of Japan took rates to zero and negative, and all of the stuff they've done over the last 35 years to try to just keep it afloat is you can certainly see the U.S. and, you know, that was just like the model for where we are headed.
And, you know, if you had bought, I thought about buying the Nikkei when it was in four digit land.
Mm-hmm.
I just am not qualified. There was no way for me to know if the Nikkei had more downside in it or not. And it would have been a great investment so far. So if we have a real global mess, how far down could the Nikkei go, right? It's sitting somewhere in the mid-30s right now.
Yeah.
So it's clawing its way up the greasy, bloody pole to get to a new high after 35 years. We'll probably take another 5 years.
Yeah.
But how low could it go if we have a global downturn? That Nikkei could deliquify fast. And could it go down to four digits again? I don't know. Seems like a big drop because I don't think it's that expensive. But in theory, it could. And then you give it all back, right?
Yeah.
What an unbelievable horror story.
Well, you make an excellent point, though. I mean, it's a really good analogy to now with how all those big Japanese companies and the Nikkei was soaring, and it looked like it was just going to be endless in 1989. And then the fall, and they cut rates, and they take rates to zero, and yield curve, and everything else that Bank of Japan has done. And now here we are 35 years later, and it's back to where it was. So it's not like it's impossible for something like that to happen.
No.
Dave, let me ask you one more economic question, and then we'll get to the other stuff. Where do you stand on interest rates, I guess, is just the easiest way to put it. You know, there are people out there that think, oh, bond market, you know, 10-year note's going to go to 8% because there's no buyers, and they're going to have higher rates. Or is it, you know, the Fed is the buyer? They know they can't keep financing all this debt at 8%. And, you know, they're just going to step back in, like the Bank of Japan, QE, yield curve control, all that stuff. Where do you stand in that argument?
Well, you know, you've seen these plots of the 70s inflation where it went up and then it came down, then it went up bigger and then it came down and then it went up bigger. And finally, we slayed it with a lot of pain. In a period of time when the U.S. debt to GDP was, the debt was something like 30% of GDP. Now we're at, what, 140% of GDP or something like that. So our debt is growing something like 10% a year, and you just can't do that.
Yeah.
I don't know where it breaks. I mean, the Japanese have a big debt to GDP too, but they've also been stagnating. It depends on whether inflation makes the Fed do something different that they didn't want to do. So if inflation rears its head, we know it's higher than they say. The idea that inflation's 3% or 4% or whatever they're saying is just a total crock of shit. And you know, the Chapwood Index puts it at, you know, sort of right now at about 13 or something like that. You know, Jimmy Iorio said that the cost of running his restaurant has risen 40% in 2 years.
Jeez.
Right. And I've asked the guy in the local diner, and he says that's about the right number, I think. So it seems to me that the people who say the Fed's going to save us by some mechanism are ignoring the fact that the Fed might get totally handcuffed by inflation. And then if the Fed tries to save us anyways, then the inflation expectations, which I think are a real problem, will then slaughter them, right? So the Fed will be under fire like crazy. If they're dropping rates and inflation's roaring, holy shit, you know, they're going to get strung up. And the bond market then is finally going to reject the Fed. That's Bill Fleckenstein's, you know, the bond market the Fed will lose control of the bond market. Or something, you know, there's so many ways this could hurt us. What I do know is once markets get overvalued, it's like in the movie with Sandra Bullock, Gravity, I think it's called, where she's up in a space station. She finds her way back to Earth through a series of outlandishly lucky moves. But that's not how life works. Once you're, you know, I have us at about 150% overvalued based on historical metrics. And you can't get back to the planet's surface, which is just fair value. I'm not even talking about a destructive run that takes us comfortably through fair value, which, by the way, mathematically, you're supposed to spend half your time below the mean, half your time above.
Right.
So to just bounce off fair value doesn't even make sense. Like in 08, 09, it ricocheted off fair value in 08, 09. It fell a lot, but it never got cheap. It's possible that the solutions, which everyone thinks are, you know, push button solutions, are simply not going to be available.
All right. Well, now, Professor, let's shift gears to society at large, which is another thing you're very good at chronicling. You are in the belly of the beast of academia to some extent. Anybody that's been paying attention to the national headlines over the last couple of months have saw what happened with Claudine Gay at Harvard and, all the circumstances surrounding that. And ultimately, you know, what people dug up on her with plagiarism and everything else. Dave, what do you, as you look forward, one, it's an election year. So as you look forward to this year, what do you see societally? But also, I mean, what can you tell us about the kids you teach? Are they all hopeless snowflakes? Or is that just a generalization? You know, we're only seeing the bad 10% and it's not as dire as it seems.
I think you're seeing mostly the bad 10%. I think that's probably, you know, I teach a bunch of kids who either want to go to med school or want to go into graduate school in chemistry.
Yeah.
And they're pretty much focused on trying to pass their courses and learn that stuff. And so it's not so bad. Once in a while I get into a little bit of a trouble because I'll say something that some fragile individual doesn't like. Shocking, I know. But if you go across the arts quad, you'll find people who are spending $250,000 to get a degree in activism. Yeah. And I think Ithaca's a little insulated from it. So Ithaca got a lot of bad press this year because of the guy who praised Hamas for slaughtering Jews, right? You know, generally praising people for slaughtering Jews is historically not a good stance to take.
Yep.
And he's been a troublemaker the whole way. He's as left wing as I am right wing. But since the right wing is the correct view, thank you very much. I'm better off. And we had trouble with some guy doing anti-Semitic shit around campus. I just had an email exchange with a very famous person who happens to be Jewish, and he is horrified by what he sees in the world of anti-Semitism.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I'm surprised at how much it picked up, because normally it's been pretty hard to criticize the Jews, and now people are out there supporting groups that kills them. Yeah. And I'm going, that was a rapid turnaround. That's an extraordinary thing to happen. And, you know, I see the Palestine Israel battle as dangerous globally because of the problems that are showing up in the cities, where it's causing social strife amongst people who actually don't even have a horse in the race at some level.
Mm-hmm.
And so there's the pro-Palestine crowd is out there in force. And I would make the argument that they were AWOL when maybe, you know, trying to protect Palestinians in some way would have been useful. I've been ranting and raving about the U.S. war machine killing people in the Middle East. Where were they?
Right.
Right. I've been railing on NATO for picking the fight that led to the Ukrainian war that's going to kill somewhere between 500,000 and 1 million Ukrainians.
Right.
Which I sincerely believe is you can put almost the entire blame on NATO. Now, there's people listening to this who are appalled by that statement.
But
I am completely confident that if NATO had tried to avoid the war, it would have been avoided.
Yes.
NATO wanted that war. And they bribed Zelensky and they bribed various Ukrainians to fight that war. And now you've got about 500,000 estimated dead Ukrainians, meaning 500,000 Ukrainian mothers who are going, you know, that wasn't worth it to me because I really don't care whether it's Zelensky or Putin looking over my shoulder. My life still has to be lived, and now it's without my son.
Yep.
I view that as a Holocaust on NATO's shoulders. We killed 4.5 million people in the Middle East. I'm a Reagan Republican, so this is not, you know, left-wing candy ass shit. This is now right-wing candy ass shit, maybe, but 4.5 million people in the Middle East in 20 years since the Twin Towers. You can't justify killing 4.5 million people because someone who has never been accurately identified killed 3,000.
Yeah. Yeah.
And we, by the way, bombed the shit out of several countries that had nothing to do with 9/11. And so it's very clear that the powers that be are more than happy to exploit our incredible stupidity as a culture to do things. But, you know, I think there are still people who believe that Iraq attacked us on 9/11.
Well, I'm sure
I don't
are.
See
yeah.
how, but you know, yeah, well, there's people who also believe in the Loch Ness Monster too. So
right, right.
Which is more probable to me.
Well, and in the end, it's about power. You know, if you can get enough
it
people
is.
To believe whatever, then you can maintain your power. It's an election year, Dave. I mean, I just think back 4 years ago. You know, yeah, it was COVID and lockdowns and all that stuff, but they took the, you know, events of George Floyd, and then that went into, you know, that just changed everything. You know, that just got everybody.
Yeah.
That's where all this DEI stuff comes from here 4 years later.
It turns out a great book by Chris Rufo. I can't remember the title because I do audiobooks, and so I don't get to see the book every time I pick it up.
Yeah.
But Chris Rufo has written a book that describes the rise of modern day neo-Marxism as a continuous flowing evolution from the 50s, a guy named Herbert Marcuse, through the 60s, you know, the Rogue, the Weathermen, and Angela Davis, and those guys. And it never stopped. They changed tactics. And by the mid-70s, they realized they had to take over academia. And they've done it. They have done it.
Yep.
And the fact that, you know, Claudine Gay is not president of Harvard doesn't negate the fact that Claudine Gay was an utterly incompetent academic who never should have gotten a job, let alone gotten tenure, let alone gotten the presidency.
Right.
So the fact that they had to fire her it shows the magnitude of the catastrophe that represents academia.
Right.
Yeah. Now, I think that's an extreme version. I the Cornell president, I'm not her biggest fan, but she doesn't seem like a total whack job. The provost is phenomenal, in my opinion. He happens to be a friend, but so maybe I'm biased. But I'd say Cornell's being run pretty well. And if they're emblematic of other schools, I think we're not as deep as people believe. But I think we got to go. I think this is not going to go away easily. I think this DEI stuff is just going to regroup and come up in new forms.
And a lot of it, well, I'm speaking too much in generalizations, but a lot of it, you know, it's gotten worse since Biden was elected.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we weren't talking so much about this transgenderism and all this other stuff 4 years ago, but a lot of that seeps down, you know, through all the government agencies. So now we have this election pending where everybody's going to make the stakes out to be again. Oh, this is the world's going to end if my side doesn't win. And that's, you get a little of that every cycle. But are you concerned about how the next 10 months are going to play out here in the U.S. and what might
actually be? I'm looking forward to it.
there you go. That's a better way to look at it.
Biden administration, I mean, Biden's a drooling idiot, right? He's not running anything. So when I say Biden, I mean, whoever is pulling the strings up there, and it's scary. His administration's just stocked with Looney Tunes. But his administration has done things that I find to be inexcusably, treasonously bad. So weaponizing the Department of Justice is outlandish what he has done, in my opinion. If you want to understand that, here's a great book. I recommend books. I read a lot of books, but I don't recommend the ones that aren't good or that are average. Michael Malice's The White Pills, A History of the Soviet Union. And what he does is this brilliantly lucid job, without getting tangled up in Russian names, describing how the Soviet Union completely devoured itself. And they killed 40 million. We know Stalin did that, but I never knew how. They didn't just line them up and shoot them. They got society to contribute and to just turn on itself and eat itself. And you're sitting there listening to this book and going, holy shit, don't let that happen here. Don't let the Cultural Revolution that happened in China happen here.
Yeah.
This is what mass movements do. Another great book is Eric Hoffer's The True Believer, which describes mass movements. Matthias Desmond's book is a more modern variant of it. And it feels like it's happening here. The Biden administration has been horrific in terms of, to me, throwing away the American system. I don't think it's because I'm right of the aisle, because I was never hard on Obama. I didn't like some of his policies, but he was still just the president to me, and a very articulate one who, when he was at the podium, he felt like someone was in charge.
Yeah.
The Biden administration really looks like they're driving us at a bridge abutment doing 100 miles an hour. And it's unforgivable when, you know, when the attorney general stands up in front of Congress and says that J6ers killed five cops. I go, you're a pathological liar. We've got an attorney general who pathologically lies to Congress in front of cameras. I'm reading articles now about how up in Canada there's still guys who are in jail without bail from the trucker rally. Please explain to me why the trucker rally wasn't the most civilized protest in the history of protests.
Yeah.
And
Yeah.
yet they've thrown people in jail too. So Chrystia Bitchface Freeland, she should be shot. I mean, she's just a pathetic excuse. She's got Ukrainian Nazi roots. That's true. And she's a globalist and she's an authoritarian. And Trudeau is just owned. He's a total puppet.
Yeah.
But the J6 prisoners right now. Biden, the other a couple weeks ago, when he bragged about putting people in prison for 870 years, I snapped. I said, "You piece of shit. You total piece of garbage. I hope you get cancer. I hope your brain rots, which it already is. I hope you die. That's wrong, what you just did." And so now I'm rooting for Trump 100%. I want Trump to get in or go Green Goblin. Now, here's the interesting question. I think it's possible that all these charges and everything are really just an attempt to push at Trump, and that they actually don't think they're gonna come to anything. I watch Trump and he sure doesn't act like he thinks he's in trouble.
Yeah.
And so it's possible that this is all just dirty politics. It's horrible politics. It's authoritarian politics, but it's still maybe. So now I'm rooting 100% for Trump. Day one, sweeping pardons of the J6 guys. If in doubt, pardon every last one of them. Just a blanket pardon. Release the tapes, which the Republicans have not done either. So two speakers have chosen not to release the tapes. Those guys should be yet kicked out again. What's the new one named? I don't even care.
Whatever his
Get
name
me a
is.
speaker of the get me a speaker of the House who releases all the tapes, and I will support that person. Until then, they are part of the problem. And by the way, Tucker had them. He didn't release them, and I don't know why. Now, maybe he didn't have them all, but I don't know why Tucker sat on the tapes. Maybe he planned on milking them or something. I don't know. But that's not good either, because people are rotting in prison.
Do you think I kind of was thinking why you were talking about are they persecuting Trump with these charges just because if he gets elected, then he'll, I mean, is there some kind of extra layer that they're trying to do here, or is it just simply on its face they're coming up with these charges trying to keep him from getting office again?
See, that's what I'm beginning to suspect, that they know that it won't stick, and he
Yeah.
knows that it won't stick. But as long as they can keep that narrative on the front page, it's possible someone can beat him. Now, here's what I'll tell you. If Biden beats him, I'm not believing it. I'm a 99% confident rigged election 2020. I don't think there's any chance that election wasn't rigged. I do polls. I'm not alone. I think most of the population thinks that election was rigged. Certainly a huge percentage of the right do. Here's the problem. It doesn't even matter if it's true. The fact that we don't trust our own elections
Right,
now is a
right,
fundamental problem. The
right.
only way we're going to trust them is they run them clean, and I don't think they're going to run them clean. But I think you can see evidence that they're starting to realize that they can't even cheat their way out of getting Trump back in the White House,
Yeah.
because he's just going to mow Biden down. They can work around the edges and get Biden a couple more million votes in here and there, but I think Trump is going to own him. I think it might be that bad. And
Can you imagine what a debate
I
would
find
look
it
like?
inexcusable people vote for Biden. And
I don't.
I can't name something that Trump did that was really horrific. Trump himself as a person, I can say, oh yeah, he's horrific. Biden has done horrific things.
I have a my oldest daughter, Dave, who voted for Biden, right? because she just got out of college and all her,
you should
know.
Do a paternity test. You should do a paternity
yeah, really.
Test on her.
Well, she was just getting out of college in 2020.
I
you know,
know.
she's surrounded by her sorority sisters, you know, and all that kind of crapola. But even she has come around, and you want to know what the one thing is? This immigration thing. She works in public health. And she's
it
like,
makes no sense. He throws
right.
the borders wide open. But so did Merkel and all the guys in Europe. So there's something so strange here.
Yes. And it makes it, that's the thing. And it makes, you can't find a way, even looking at it from different angles, where you can make it make sense. On a traditional,
I have found a way, but it's what's going to get me in trouble. And
it's
that is,
sinister.
I think it's about global pedophilia networks.
Well, you mentioned,
I think Epstein's the tip of the iceberg.
Well, that's a whole other story right there.
Well, but it could be. So I can give you examples of people who agree. I was on a Zoom call with a former CIA. It was actually Department of Defense case worker, which is kind of a DOD CIA equivalent. And I was able to pepper him with questions. And this guy named Tony Schaefer, at one point I asked him, I said, I'm interested in trafficking this year. And he starts talking about Epstein. I go, no, we all know Epstein was trafficking. We all know they sanitized the hell out of the story. And they've hidden the names of the people he's trafficking to. Now I'm more interested in the deeper, darker stuff. And I said, let me ask you this. Here's a question I said to him. Okay, let's keep it simple. Is the Clinton Foundation trafficking kids? And he said, absolutely, 100%. So that shows you the depths of the depravity. And I'd already built the case against the Clintons. I've got 150 pages of notes. The case against the Clinton Foundation trafficking kids is very strong, but to have a DOD caseworker say yes, and it's true. And then Archbishop Vigano, who's very high up in the Vatican, has been accusing the leaders of the world to be child trafficker pedophiles who are making their decisions about global politics based on that. The former Secretary General of the United Nations has come out and said that pedophilia is the currency of geopolitics. That's how he phrased it.
Jeez.
So these are not trivial people. And, you know, various Hollywood producers have talked about it. Serious producers who've produced things you're familiar with have come out and said these are the various pedophiles. It's rampant. And so I think it's quite possible that pedophilia is really wagging the dog in a way that most people, if you showed them the data, they would not be able to process it.
Because you just can't believe it. It's so immoral, amoral.
But it's beyond that. So it's child sacrifice. It's torture. It's things that you go, I don't see how anyone would ever do that.
Right.
It's Jeffrey Dahmer's level. It's
right.
Jeffrey Dahmer's level.
And that's
and yet it seems to be broadly based.
And that's why
the
people
problem.
Have a hard time believing it, don't you think, Dave? Because it just seems so atrocious.
Well, so that's the problem I'm having.
Ponder it.
I'm trying to confirm or refute, or how do you, you're not going to get this off CNN.
Right.
And so then the question is, how do you know you're not being duped? So if you'd asked me 3 months ago, who's the biggest Satanist, who's the most famous Satanist on the planet, it would have been easier. I would have said, Marina Abramovic. She is an overt Satanist. There's actually articles written about her. She's sitting there with a skinned goat's head and, you know, sitting on carcasses and shit like that, and sitting having dinner parties with fake cadavers. I hope they're fake cadavers with famous people. Well, she just got appointed by Zelensky to oversee the school system in the Ukraine, which, by the way, is a hub of child trafficking.
Mind-blowing
is right. And so the woman who got caught twice trafficking kids in Haiti, Laura Silsby, makes calls into the Clinton crime family, and they spring her. She now works for the Amber Alert system.
Oh, goodness gracious.
And this is, so I believe if you wanted to find pedophiles, high-level pedophiles, what you do is you find the organizations that supposedly are supposed to be fighting that story.
Yeah.
That's where they are. I think the pedophilia network has got control. And so they get money, right? Oh, go, here's more money. Go find the traffickers. Tell me who you know, a person in a position of power. This is a sea of this. I want to know if you can name someone who has been gotten a serious jail sentence for trafficking. And if you come up with one, I know who it's going to be. It's going to be Denny Hastert.
Oh, right, right. Former Speaker of the House.
Former trafficked people who are now adults are calling out unbelievably famous people for having done unbelievably heinous things. And I'm sitting there going, either this person is a complete fraud or the world is, it's a matrix problem. It's I took the red pill.
Yeah. Well,
and now I can see this world and I'm going, holy shit.
Well, last question.
I'm racked by the ambiguity.
Well, last question, Dave. One, will you write that 115 pages? I guess is 1A.
I'm going to write it. I'm writing it.
Just whether that sees the light of day, I suppose.
And that's the second question.
But the other one then is, with all of this becoming more, apparent, publicized, more people becoming aware, you know, the internet does all this, you know, allows people to find out these things. How does that impact the election? I mean, you would think if on one side that's, they've got a pretty significant incentive to try to keep everything, you know, in the dark.
Well, so there's information out there that doesn't ever seem to have an effect. And it tells me the Republicans are not willing to use it.
Yeah.
So when Clinton pardoned 1,120 people, I one day saw a news story on local news and they showed about 15 people he pardoned. And I remember one vividly, some guy who was in prison for having smuggled 800 kilos of cocaine. I'm going, okay, so that storyline is going to be hard to write without concluding the Clintons are bad, which I already had, so it didn't shock me. But, and you could imagine a scenario in which some nephew of some drug lord got put in prison, and because of geopolitics, Clinton said, I'll tell you what, you know, you let us put an airbase in your country, we'll pardon your nephew. You know, you can imagine some story like that.
Yeah.
But of the 1,120, they were all bank fraud and drugs, all of them. I went through the list. It used to be easy to find. Now it's hard to find, but I do know how to find it. And so it's clear Clinton just sold 1,120 pardons.
Right.
And so then the question is, you know, why did, and remember when the Republicans chased him around for pardoning Mark Rich, who I think was Mossad. So one could imagine all sorts of complexity in that story.
Yeah, I suppose.
But the Republicans chased him around for pardoning Mark Rich when they had phenomenal dirt in his pardons that were public knowledge and they didn't use it. So then the question is why? And the answer is because they're part of the dirt.
Yeah, right, right.
So you don't draw blood. It's like dogs playing in the yard. They fight and they snarl and you see teeth and all sorts of crap, but there's no injuries. They lick their balls and go to sleep.
Yeah. Well, Dave, what an interesting conversation this has been.
I've been going dark lately. Yeah, this is my podcasts are all going down the same. If someone is binging all my podcasts, you must think you're listening to a tape recorder. Fortunately, the Venn diagrams of the different podcasts is not so big. But I'm overexposed, but I love talking to guys like you. So, and people ask different questions, so there's that. But yeah, so I will write the pedophile story, and there really are enough pieces of seemingly hard data to anchor the story. I think Pizzagate's undeniably real, for example. And if you buy the Pizzagate story, you're into the darkest of the darkness. And I believe it.
I'd be interested to read what you write. That's for sure, Dave.
Well, I will send it to people even if I don't publish it.
Well,
I talked to Brendan Eich, actually, who created Firefox and created Brave. So he's a techie. He was pre-IPO Netflix. And I asked him if there's a way to truly anonymously publish something. And I didn't get a definitive answer.
Yeah.
If someone out there is listening who knows how to publish something that's truly not traceable.
Untraceable. Yeah.
Yeah, then well, I'd love to know about it.
And this is what, you know, people should take from the last 15 minutes. So you're not a lunatic. You know, you're not some random person on the internet that, you know, writes something that you don't know anything about, that they just appeared to come from nowhere, you know, and post some video on YouTube or whatever. Dave, I'm curious to read what you write, because you're just a smart guy whom I respect. And
I could be on the wrong path on this one.
You could, and you could. And that's
the fact checking is the fact checking is nearly impossible. The whole thing is in your window.
Yeah. Yeah. Of course it's impossible. I mean, that's why they've been able, if all of this is true, that's why they've been able to do it, because all the tracks are so covered and so many people are complicit. But Dave, it's always fascinating to speak with you. As we wrap up, you mentioned, I mean, people don't have to come up and sign up for an organic chemistry class to hear from you. You're on podcasts all the time. Do you do that series still with the two gyms, Urio and Kunstler?
Well, Iorio and Iacino,
that's right.
I was scheduled to do one of those earlier this week, and they came up with a conflict. We've been having trouble. I'm so booked now. I have a rule of no more than one a day, and I had two on a day earlier this week, and Daniela Cambone tried to wedge in a third, and I said, I just can't do it. I will be so robotic by the end of the second one. I'll be worthless, whoever gets me third.
But what I'm remembering, Dave, is that I guess instead, did you do some stuff with Kunstler and Luongo?
Kunstler, Luongo, and Tommy Kerrigan. Someone noticed Tommy Kerrigan's been dead silent on Twitter. We're wondering if there's a problem there. If anyone knows if Tommy's healthy or not, reach out, because someone said his Twitter feed has gone quiet, which is, for some of us, a quiet Twitter feed means something's wrong.
Yeah, right. Well, Dave, let's be sure to keep in touch. We have not had a chance to speak for maybe a year or two.
Well, let me ask you this. What do you think is going to happen with gold? What do you think is going to happen with gold? A year from now, where's gold?
I wrote my annual macrocast, which to me is like a little yoke on my shoulders. I'm always so glad to get it done. I'm sure you kind of know a little bit about
I do that. Understand that.
I don't think a whole lot happens this year. I think you got a lesson from the banks back on December 3rd and 4th, when everything was pointing toward a breakout. And on Sunday night at 6:15 Eastern, they let it surge $60, only then to just to hammer it back to where it was down 60. The banks are perfectly happy seeing gold go up 10% a year. They can make a lot of money at that, but they are not happy seeing it go up 50.
So do you think, so someone like Fleckenstein totally opposes the idea that gold's manipulated, besides the fact that there's just traders in cubicles who are happy to push it around to make money. That's not manipulation. No market looks organic the way they used to. They all look like they're algo driven. Being pushed around.
They're algo driven.
But do you think the gold market's being manipulated for specific reasons, or do you think it's just the whipsaw that you'd expect?
It's manipulated for bank profit more than anything else. I think there are times still when maybe the Bank of International Settlements gets involved. The history is all there. Hell, the convictions are all there now too, Dave. For someone like Fleckenstein to say it's not, when you've got the head of JP Morgan's precious metals desk doing time in a federal prison.
Well, but he could, in theory, be just manipulating the market for his own personal gain.
Right.
Which to me, but that's not manipulation. Manipulation to me is, that's manipulating it that's gaming the market. Okay. Manipulation of the kind I'm talking about is where someone in very, you know, some Davos level squad is saying, we got to keep control of the gold market. And you remember Volcker at one point said that, but that was also back when gold mattered.
Yeah.
And,
there's a reason to keep control of the gold market with all the leveraged rehypothecation, the leases, everything else. There's far more derivative exposure and future demands on the same out. You know, there's maybe 100 demands.
Does GLD represent gold demand in your opinion or not? Does GLD take gold off the market?
No.
I don't think so either.
No, individuals can't. Institutions can't. Only the banks can redeem
baskets
of
no.
shares for that thing.
But
So
the question
it does not.
is, when there's a, I hear claims of GLD taking in gold and selling gold, and I don't know why that would happen, because it seems to me it should function like a closed-end fund.
It's almost
unless there's an arbitrage mechanism where if it starts getting bid up, they do something. Like the Central Fund of Canada used to do that, and then shareholders used to benefit, but I think they figured that scam out and started skimming the profits themselves. So the question is if there's, does GLD take in gold? Is it hyper-fractional reserve?
It's fractional reserve. It's actually, if it's anything, it is counterintuitive in that the banks, the bullion banks, which are the authorized participants, use it to flywheel demand, physical metal in and out of those vaults in London to meet demand. And so they may short and sell a basket of shares so that they can get their hands on gold immediately for an immediate physical demand in
London.
See,
I thought maybe it was to absorb demand to keep it away from the metal itself.
Well, yes. I mean, that's all part of why it was developed in the first place. But now it's more counterintuitive in that when the price of gold is going up and there's demand for it, you'll often see the amount of shares and the amount of metal supposedly in the fund go down. And then the banks will pay back that short as price goes down, and they can buy it back on the market and put it back in. And so price is going down and metal's going back up. And it's not like that all the time every day, but that's more how that thing operates than as a reflection of retail demand, you know.
Right.
And I think that's what you're getting at.
Then the question is the hodlers. I actually think the ETF is bad news for the hodlers.
Oh, absolutely. You get exposure to price is all you get, Dave.
Right.
If you think you own physical metal, you don't. It's like the people that own unallocated accounts, you know, and stuff like that. The only metal that anybody knows they own is the stuff that they've got. And
right.
And whether it's gaming it or manipulating it or managing it, you know, is the Fed gaming, manipulating, and managing the bond market? I
yes
mean, depends on which.
that is gaming, manipulating the bond
yeah.
market. No,
so
that,
what
that
what term do you want to use?
But
banks,
I distinguish between some guy in a cubicle who's doing it to make his vig versus authorities.
Right. Well, and that's what I'm getting at, Dave. They can, you can, as a bullion banker and on your trading desk, you know, you can perfectly fine making 10%, you know, seeing gold price go up 10% a year and being short most of the time, because you can manage that market. You've got monopolistic control on how many contracts are issued, and you know, the Dodd-Frank provisions against position limits doesn't apply to you because you've told the CFTC that you're just hedging. And so you can manage price even while it's going up. People say, well, how can there be manipulation with price going up? Because the banks can still make money at it. It's when they get threatened to have it really get away from them, like what happened in
right.
December, that's
they
they
get
can't
cut off sides.
Right. They can't stomach that. And then that's when you get these what are clearly moved. So anyway, putting all that back together in my annual forecast, I said, well, you see right now, you saw that in December. They're not ready for it to break out to 23, 25. Because they fought so hard to keep that from happening in December. So I think this year, getting all the way back to your original question, Professor, we may see 2,300 at one point. We'll probably finish the year closer to 22, something like that. That would be my idea. That day's coming for gold. Day's
right.
coming that the system and the pricing scheme fails, but I don't think it's this year, unfortunately.
God, I'd love to be able to sell into a bubble 5 years from now.
Yeah. Well, now again, Dave, here we're going way long, but remember, that's the thing. If you're selling into it, what are you going to sell your gold for? You're going to get dollars back for it? And then
well,
what are you going to do?
You know, well, if you can, for example, take dollars and buy, you know, Exxon with a PE of 6 and a dividend
yeah.
yield, right?
Yeah.
There are things for which the metric tells you it's a good buy.
Yes, that's true. And maybe it's land, maybe it's
yeah, right.
something else
right.
that it would seem to be, you know, you're just swapping out from something overvalued
if
under.
If gold gets to the point where I can buy a house with an ounce of gold, I'm going to call that overpriced.
It'd be fine. I think everybody listening to us would go, yeah, that'd be fine.
Yeah, that'd be cool. I would rather not be in gold. I mean, I would rather be in some productive asset, but, you know, opportunities have not knocked in a way that made me feel good.
Well, and the times are such that you need that insurance policy. You know, you need that, what gold does.
Right.
And you, I'd rather be the same way too. I'd much rather be just, nah, everything's great. I don't, what do I need this for? You know, everything's sound. The system is sound. But unfortunately it's not. So we got to keep owning it. My friend, it's always so much fun to talk to you. We've
Okay.
droned on for about an hour. We should probably let everybody else go.
Okay.
But please, if I contact you by about summertime or the time of the conventions and all that stuff, please come join me again because this is going to be such a crazy year and I'd love to get an update.
I'm really looking forward to the election.
It's going to be
I it
fun.
just
At least say that. It'll be
it
something
will
to.
be and I can't see a path that's not at some level exciting, whether it's horrible news is a separate issue, but I don't see a path that's boring.
No. And since there's really nothing we can do about it, it becomes just theater. So it might as well be entertaining to some
That's
extent.
right.
It's going to be
That's right.
entertaining.
That's right.
Dave, thank you so
Well,
much. It's always fun to visit with you again. This has been Dave Collum, old friend of ours, writes the year in review. I'll put that link on this page. I'll find it somewhere, wherever it's at, so that you can spend some, everybody listening can spend some time listening to it. And Dave will hopefully do this again soon, my friend. Thank you.
thank you.
From all of us here at TFMR, thank you for listening. Have a great weekend, and we'll get right back to work on Monday.